And we'll move on into the team updates. We're doing updates because many people had requested that they wanted to hear what other people were working on, what barriers they were having, and those type issues. So that's why we're asking everybody to be prepared to do this as we move through the webinars, so that you can share and people can share with you. So our first place, CMC.
This is CMC. Right now we're just kind of forming our teams. We've received the toolkit, our system-wide QSOC established a toolkit, and we're in the process of reviewing those things now. Our high-risk postpartum unit has actually kind of been working on this already, so they've already been doing, like, drills. They took 1 month, and, like, every week they did a drill on preeclampsia. They did a poster board with tips. We do a lean huddle every morning, so we do a tip of the week every week related to preeclampsia. They post it kind of, like, did you know about preeclampsia all around the unit or whatever, just as kind of reminders. And they did, each staff member had to do like a post test that was signed off by a physician champion. So we, and they also had to do like a reenactment video. So we're taking that same concept and going to try to roll it out to some of the other areas in the division just for more educational opportunities. So that's kind of what we're doing now. Our biggest challenge is that we're behind the eight ball. We're getting a late start. So we really don't have any barriers identified yet. And the solution, some solutions, we're going to definitely use the toolkit that was already established by other facilities in our system.
Great. Okay, Stuart, you're up.
All right, this is a presentation I put together for our department's grand rounds. And in this setting, we have our OB doctors as well as the labor and delivery nurses. And they're welcome to come and attend. And with the new guidelines that were published, there was a lot of new information. And knowing that we were going to be part of this project, we wanted to get everybody on board. Okay, next slide. So after I reviewed our first month's data, the first thing I was looking at was, did we use the right definition for the patient's diagnosis? So we had a total of 36 patients for the month. 16 of those had gestational hypertension. One written in the chart was with a diagnosis of PIH, which is not a diagnosis that we should be using. We had 14 patients who had preeclampsia with severe features. We had 5 patients who had preeclampsia without severe features. One of those was categorized as having severe based on proteinuria, which, as we're going to talk about a little bit later, is no longer a criteria for severe. The patient was beyond 37 weeks, so the management was appropriate. They just had the wrong diagnosis. And we had one patient with chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia. So one of the things we're going to work on is getting the correct diagnosis, because it can alter your management if you have the wrong diagnosis. So, next slide. A couple other things that I noticed. One was patients who have preeclampsia with severe features should be receiving magnesium sulfate as seizure prophylaxis. So out of our 14 patients who had severe features, only 10 of those received magnesium. And so I've talked to these physicians and educated them about why the patients should have gotten magnesium. And often the reason they didn't get it is because they said their blood pressures were not in the severe range, even though they had other criteria for severe. And according to the guidelines, if they meet the criteria for severe, they should get magnesium, regardless of whether their blood pressures hit the severe range or not. So that's one area we need to work on. And next slide. And the last thing I noticed was the guidelines state that if a patient is on magnesium, it should be continued during their caesarean. And we had 5 patients who were on magnesium who had caesareans that should have had that continued. And 2 of those, it was either discontinued or started after their caesarean. And once again, this is an education process where we had to talk to the providers and tell them that it really needs to be continued. And this is an area we need to work on, because what we found was the provider said, well, we wrote for it, but anesthesia wouldn't give it. And when I talked to anesthesia, they said, well, the nurses stopped the pump. So there's a whole lot of folks pointing to other folks saying they're the reason that it wasn't given. So we got to figure out who was stopping the magnesium and educate them about why it needs to be continued and this is definitely something we're going to track in the next few months. All right, next slide. So the ACOG Task Force published their hypertension and pregnancy guidelines back in November, and they had several areas that they covered in that publication. Classification of hypertensive diseases, the diagnosis of each specific disease, the management, prevention in future pregnancies, as well as future implications outside of pregnancy. And today what I'm going to cover briefly is just the classification, diagnosis, and a little bit about management, in particular seizure prophylaxis. Next. So the task force, when they put out their recommendations, either had a strong recommendation or a qualified recommendation, and then the evidence on which that recommendation was made is either classified as low quality, moderate quality, or high quality. And so with each of the recommendations in the PowerPoint presentation that I will be presenting here, I'm going to tell you whether or not it was either a strong or a qualified recommendation and what the quality of evidence was. Next slide. And there's a copy of these slides on the PCNIC website. The entire presentation is there. Today's is just a small sample of the slides. And I also published or wrote up some clinical guidelines that goes through each of these, including chronic hypertension, which we're not going to talk about today. And that's also on the website. If anybody wants to print that out and use it at their facility, they're welcome to do so. But it goes through diagnosis, management to include antenatal testing, seizure prophylaxis, what to do in future pregnancies, and even what to do postpartum as far as how to follow these patients because they are at risk for cardiovascular disease later in life. So the classification of hypertension in pregnancy is either chronic hypertension, gestational hypertension, preeclampsia, which can be either with or without severe features, and chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia. Once again, that superimposed preeclampsia can be with or without severe features. Next slide. So PIH is a term that is used an awful lot. I don't know about other labor and delivery units in the state, but certainly I hear this term a whole lot in the places I've worked. And if you look back at the ACOG bulletins back as far ago as 2000, they recommended not using the term PIH. But it's one of those terms that's kind of stuck around for a long time, I think because it's easier to say and easier to write than preeclampsia is, but it's one that we really should not be using because it doesn't fall into one of the classifications that ACOG has recommended we ought to use for diagnosing hypertensive diseases. Next. They also recommend in this most recent publication not to use the term mild preeclampsia, but instead to call it preeclampsia without severe features. And that's a whole lot harder to say preeclampsia without severe features than mild preeclampsia, but we really need to get in the habit of using the correct terminology. Throughout their publication, they often will use the term severe preeclampsia interchangeably with preeclampsia with severe features. But the classification itself notes to use preeclampsia with severe features as the correct diagnosis. Next slide. So to diagnose hypertension, the blood pressure needs to be, systolic needs to be greater than or equal to 140, or the diastolic greater than or equal to 90. You do not have to have both of these. Only one of those would qualify as having hypertension. Severe hypertension, the values are 160 for systolic and 110 for diastolic. And again, you don't have to have both of those to qualify as severe hypertension. You can have either or both. And by the new guidelines, these blood pressures should be taken 4 hours apart. The old guidelines, they were 6 hours apart. Next slide. Although they do add a caveat that if you're in the severe range, you don't have to wait until you get two blood pressures 4 hours apart to institute treatment. That if you have severe hypertension, you can make a diagnosis of severe hypertension and treat them so that you're not increasing the risk of strokes or other problems associated with severe hypertension. Next slide. For proteinuria, proteinuria is still considered one of the diagnosis criteria for preeclampsia. And there are choices as to how you diagnose someone with proteinuria. The gold standard is a 24-hour urine that is 300 milligrams or greater. There are a lot of places, including our hospital, that will sometimes use a PC ratio. Some facilities are also using timed urines where they'll do a 6 or 12-hour collection and then extrapolate that out to 24. And if you don't have any of those, a urine dipstick that is 1 plus or greater. But the urine dipstick should only be used if there's nothing else available. The 24-hour urine is best. Probably a PC ratio would be my second choice. Next slide. So let's just talk about definitions for each of these classifications. For chronic hypertension, the definition is that they should have a diagnosis of hypertension based on the blood pressure levels that I talked about a few slides ago. And that hypertension needs to be present either before the pregnancy, or if it's someone who hasn't had a lot of medical care before the pregnancy, that they have hypertension before they're 20 weeks pregnant. And with a lot of patients that show up after 20 weeks for their initial visit, and you don't have any medical records predating the pregnancy, it's often difficult to determine if they have chronic hypertension or gestational hypertension or preeclampsia. But hopefully you'll have some records available or patients come in early for prenatal care so you can make this diagnosis without getting into the dilemma of trying to figure out, is it chronic hypertension or one of the other diagnoses? Next slide. So gestational hypertension is a woman who develops hypertension after 20 weeks, and she does not have proteinuria. She also does not have severe features. We're going to talk about what the severe features are in just another slide or two. So once again, to be gestational hypertension, they have to have hypertension after 20 weeks, no proteinuria, and when I say no proteinuria, less than 300 milligrams in 24 hours, and they have to have an absence of any severe features. Next slide. Preeclampsia can be diagnosed in one of two ways. The first is a patient has hypertension that is new since 20 weeks, plus they have proteinuria, or they have hypertension that is new after 20 weeks, and one of the other signs of multisystemic involvement, which would include persistent CNS symptoms, either visual symptoms or headaches, pulmonary edema, renal dysfunction, liver impairment, or thrombocytopenia. Renal dysfunction is defined as a serum creatinine that is greater than or equal to 1.1, or a doubling of their baseline creatinine. Liver impairment is epigastric or right upper quadrant pain, or liver function tests that are twice normal value. And thrombocytopenia is platelets that are less than 100,000. Now, each of these obviously is in a patient who doesn't have some other cause that would make them have impaired liver function or thrombocytopenia or renal dysfunction. So once again, you do not have to have proteinuria to diagnose preeclampsia. If they have severe features but no proteinuria, they would still have preeclampsia by this new definition. Next slide. So preeclampsia with severe features, in addition to the things I just talked about, also blood pressure. If they have a blood pressure that's greater than 160 systolic or 110 diastolic, in the absence of other severe features, that by itself would then qualify them to have preeclampsia with severe features. Next slide. So this slide just shows you under the old classification how severe preeclampsia was diagnosed, and then under the new classification and the things that are different are highlighted in yellow. So the blood pressure criteria only has to be 4 hours apart as opposed to 6 hours. Under the new classification, the renal dysfunction is defined more clearly. Oliguria and proteinuria are no longer part of the renal criteria for severe preeclampsia. and growth restriction, which previously was a part of severe preeclampsia, was the only fetal component to severe preeclampsia, is no longer used to qualify for having preeclampsia with severe features. Okay, next slide. And then the last classification diagnosis would be chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia. So once again, the chronic hypertension component is having hypertension that is before pregnancy or before 20 weeks. Plus, to say it's superimposed, they have to have the new finding of either proteinuria that is worsening or one of the other criteria that would make their preeclampsia severe. So to say that they have chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia, but that preeclampsia is without severe features, then they have only the hypertension and proteinuria. And the proteinuria can either be new or proteinuria that has increased since the beginning of their pregnancy. And hopefully you should be getting a baseline 24-hour urine on these patients with chronic hypertension earlier in the pregnancy so you can determine if that proteinuria is worsening or not. To diagnose chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia and severe features requires that they have pre-existing hypertension. They may or may not have proteinuria that is present or worsening, but the key here is that they do have one of those severe features that would make their preeclampsia severe. So the CNS symptoms, the liver involvement, the renal involvement, pulmonary edema, those are the things that would shift them from having chronic hypertension with superimposed preeclampsia without severe to now having preeclampsia that is severe. Okay, next slide. Next slide. I think that was just blank. So as far as seizure prophylaxis, for women that have gestational hypertension or they have preeclampsia without severe features, magnesium does not have to be universally used. Now, there are some places that may still elect to give magnesium to those patients that have preeclampsia without severe features. Obviously, patients whose blood pressures are in the upper 150s or bordering on the diastolic values, physicians may elect to start those patients on magnesium, and that's not wrong to do so. It's just that you don't universally have to use it for patients without severe features. These patients, if they have gestational hypertension or preeclampsia without severe features at the onset of their labor, they need to be watched closely because they can develop severe preeclampsia during the course of their labor. If that becomes apparent, then magnesium should be started then. Okay, next. Patients who have preeclampsia with severe features or patients who seize during labor, magnesium sulfate should be used for those patients. And this is one of the strongest recommendations in the whole publication. The quality of evidence for these patients is very high, and the recommendation is strong. Within this recommendation, they also discuss that if the patient is on magnesium and goes to cesarean delivery, that magnesium should be continued during the cesarean delivery as well as postpartum. It should not be stopped just for the C-section. Next slide. For women that have superimposed preeclampsia, whether or not to start magnesium sulfate depends on if they have severe features or not. If they do not have severe features, magnesium sulfate is not universally indicated. If they do have severe features, they should be treated just like a patient who has preeclampsia with severe features or eclampsia. They should be given magnesium sulfate. Next slide. All right, so any questions?
Hey, Stuart, it's Arthur. I have a question for you. The question I've been sort of struggling. The patient that comes in with a blood pressure of 165 over 110 and no proteinuria and no other severe features is categorized as blank. Is it gestational hypertension?
The way I interpret the guidelines, she would have preeclampsia with severe features because her blood pressure would then put her in that severe range. So I guess
that's what I've been doing, but I've had a lot of very colorful conversations with some of my residents who when they read you know, the same primary source. And that's just the one that I kind of struggle with. I mean, I think we treat them like, I mean, we used to call it severe gestational hypertension, which doesn't exist.
Right.
And I'm not suggesting calling it, but they're also the disease that's so concerning that, to me, it sort of flips them over to a severe feature. I'm just trying to get a sense from, especially others in the group, your opinion as well, of kind of how people are classifying that. Because I know people are, you know, the reason, and thank you very, very much for giving this talk. So I think one of the struggles and the questions I've been getting from people is how do I classify this? You know, I have this condition, you know, the provider called it one thing, but I think it's something else. And there are a lot of interpretations, even though we think the criteria are pretty clear cut. And that's just the one that tends to come up a lot.
Proteinuria is not
learning
required
blood pressures
to make
proteinuria. Right.
Yeah, it says proteinuria is not required to make a diagnosis of preeclampsia. Someone whose blood pressure is in the severe range, I would call them preeclampsia with severe features.
Right.
So, by the way, I interpret it, there's no such thing now as severe gestational hypertension.
Correct.
Gestational hypertension, you should have blood pressures that are in the mild range, and you should not have any other symptoms of preeclampsia. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, that's kind of how I view it, too, but I'm just kind of curious because it's always good to have, you know, willing co-conspirators in that position. Yeah.
Where does the four-hour interval in following blood pressures fit into that 165 over 100? That's a pretty strong step to take with one blood pressure reading.
Right. Well, ACOG in their publication says you don't need to wait 4 hours in the setting of severe hypertension, that you may be able to make that diagnosis within minutes so that you can initiate treatment. So they do not recommend with a blood pressure in the severe range that you wait 4 hours.
But I see the circumstance from fairly often where it's 165 over 100 when they first walk in the door, and 15 minutes later it's, you know, 152 over 94.
Right. It could go down on its own without any treatment. And then in that situation, I guess it would be reasonable, if that's the only criteria they have, it would be reasonable to observe them and see if it goes back up again within that four-hour time frame.
Okay, I'm just trying to get a sense
beyond,
of...
Yeah, but if they're beyond 37 weeks, obviously you're going to go ahead and move forward with delivering them if they still got elevated blood pressure. It's just a matter of do you start them on MAG or not.
Right,
and that
right.
may be one of those patients that I would err on the side of giving a MAG. I mean, the guidelines don't say you can't use MAG for those without severe features. It just says you don't have to universally use it.
Thank you.
Sure.
I have several questions trying to categorize patients. This is Rex, by
okay.
the way. Yeah, this is Rex. So here are a few of the things I came across. With the liver function, what specific number am I looking for? Because our lab gives our normal in a range. So
right.
if I'm looking for a double of the normal, am I doubling
right.
the highest value?
Yes, that's typically what we do. We take the upper normal and double
okay.
that.
Okay. And then if they fall under the severe range, the question number 4C, the criteria to determine, for renal insufficiency, is that just the serum creatinine? Or if they have an elevated UPC ratio or 24-hour urine, do you want us to circle back?
No, the renal dysfunction is only for those patients that have an elevated creatinine. Proteinuria
okay.
doesn't play into diagnosing severe at all. Now, one thing that
okay,
came up with us, we did have one patient that we called severe features based on oliguria, even though that's not in the criteria now. But this is a patient
mm-hmm.
that had persistently urine output of about 10 to 12 cc's an hour for about 10 hours, despite mm-hmm. fluid boluses. In my
okay.
opinion, she had renal insufficiency, even though by the strict definition she didn't. But we certainly didn't want to wait until her creatinine climbed to 1.1.
Right.
The
majority of our severes are blood pressure. That's what's qualifying
right.
them. So then,
yeah, either blood
then
pressure or symptoms is what we're finding.
Number 7, for the primary indication for delivery, we have had a few patients that come in for a scheduled induction for post-date or a scheduled repeat C-section, and that's when we've discovered they have these high pressures. What I did other down at the bottom, it didn't seem like a maternal medical complication, but I didn't know where else to put these people. They were scheduled induction.
Yeah, I guess that's a better question for Tammy. I mean, if they show up in labor, I've been checking labor, and then we just happen to diagnose them with preeclampsia during labor. But if they're showing up for an induction,
or
for an induction, that's the whole reason they're there. And the induction
wasn't
based on preeclampsia. I would say their induction was for, that would fall under other, and they just coincidentally were diagnosed with preeclampsia.
Right. Yeah, Stuart, it's Arthur. Yeah, your guys are right on. I mean, the reason that question was put in because we're trying to distinguish those that are being managed for preeclampsia or those that happen to have preeclampsia. They're there 39 weeks for a scheduled repeat section. Their reason for delivery was 39-week scheduled section, not because they were preeclamptic. That's right. So I think you'd have to find that, I think you'd have to use your best judgment, but I think it really becomes important, particularly in that less than 37-week crowd, because we're really trying to distinguish people. She has preeclampsia with that severe feature. She got delivered at 35 weeks because she abrupted or because she pre-prommed or she, had some other reason for delivery. And I think we're using that to try to distinguish, really why they get delivered and kind of how Stuart said it, is because they happen to have another condition and happen to have preeclampsia, or preeclampsia is really their focus and their primary issue.
Right. And I think, the primary purpose of this initiative, at least my understanding, was to see how many patients who had what we used to call mild preeclampsia, now we say without severe features, how many of those are being delivered before 37 weeks? And I'm pleased, based on our first month's data, that we're not seeing that, but I have found other things that I wasn't expecting. So I think other hospitals may find the same sort of thing in their institution. The primary reason we're doing this is not a problem, but we're not using MAG appropriately, or we're not using it during a C-section. So I think we're going to get some benefit out of this study, even if it's not what our primary endpoint was supposed to be looking at.
We're finding our diagnosis is all over the map. So that's going to be something to work on, because we're getting the same patients being called PIH, mild preeclampsia, elevated blood pressures. We're seeing everything. And I'm assuming I've included the two patients who developed their high pressures in the postpartum period while they were still in the hospital.
I think we should be including those patients, even if it's a postpartum diagnosis.
Was a postpartum diagnosis?
Yeah, so I included them, but their pressures didn't show up till after they delivered. Is that right?
It was a postpartum diagnosis, so, and especially they were delivered for another indication. I think, we're still looking for that overall, the overall incidence, so to speak. So I think that's totally legit. Which kind of goes back to one of the TAMI data collection warnings at the beginning, since we're kind of switching between data collection issues and Stuart's insights. The one thing about data collection you are going to have to do near the end of the month is your total number of deliveries, because obviously you can't do your total number of deliveries for a month before the month is over. So that might be the one thing you might have to kind of make sure you log in and give us that total number of deliveries. But kind of like Tammy said, don't wait to the last minute to put all your delivery information in, because that's a little onerous. So you will have to log in to be able to put in your total number of deliveries. So
we tried to put in our
question.
Okay. I have one more question.
Is there a place? I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is Rex again. My last question was that Blue Cross, this is a silly one, on the very last, number 9, payer, Blue Cross Blue Shield State Health Plan, is that only if they have the state health plan version of Blue Cross Blue Shield? Because we have a lot of Blue Cross Blue Shield that's not the state health plan.
We've been doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
And honestly, people ask that question, why do we collect that? I mean, part of what we're doing is trying to get a sense, we're trying to build support for this initiative, so knowing who it's affecting is a very helpful thing. It's not, is it a Medicaid, it's just, I think it's just a Medicaid patient problem. I don't think that's going to be the case at all. But I think, I think it's one way that we can engage, the people that we work with. So I mean, this is a problem across the spectrum is what I suspect the data is going to show. But I think anyone with Blue Cross Blue Shield, it's commonly referred to as state health plan, but I think anyone with Blue Cross Blue Shield can be put in that, especially in healthcare reform time where people are jumping onto different plans.
Going to your point about collecting, I just wanted to comment on your comment about collecting who their insurer is. My understanding is one of our earlier projects, when Blue Cross saw that there was quite a few patients with Blue Cross insurance, I think it may have been the 39-week project, but whatever project it was, we identified a lot of those patients with Blue Cross insurance. I think they then later on kicked in some money to help with part of the initiative. So That was one of the reasons I think they started collecting data on insurers, because sometimes these insurers will help us out with funding.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, we're just trying to partner with people, and I think, you know, understanding what their problems are, or telling them, hey, do you realize this is an issue for you guys? We're something that we're seeing. So a little bit logical, but I've just been loving the discussion. This is as a sort of a side note of how you're looking for one thing and you find other things. And I think that's totally true, because if you actually look at the aim of the study, while we do have certain outcome measures, the aim of the study is to provide the education and support necessary to develop standards of care in North Carolina hospitals for the patient with preeclampsia. So all these other things that you're finding are driving quality. And now how do you measure it? May be difficult, but when you're realizing, hey, people aren't getting magnesium when they should, hey, look, we're misclassifying people into which type of preeclampsia that they have or hypertensive disorder they have. How do I measure blood pressure? Are we really doing blood pressures the way? It's all these conversations that people are having in their PDSA cycles and other type of work that improves care across the spectrum, which is really the bigger goal of this. I mean, it's not just the data collection, it's important, but it's all these other really cool things you guys are finding out and trying to improve as you're looking at sometimes what seems like completely different type of outcome. So, you know, I just encourage you and thank you for finding those things and, working mm-hmm. to improve them, even if it's not a true part of the initiative as far as a measurable outcome.
All right. Before I sign off, I just had one question. One of your comments reminded me. The total number of deliveries that we have each month, is there a place on the Delphi page for us to put that in? I haven't seen it yet.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Tammy, I've been logged on late, so I don't know.
Okay. It automatically, on the last day of the month, should create a survey for you. I know there was a little bit of lag time between for this month, but they are there now. So if you look back and see if you have any incomplete surveys, you should find that one. If you don't,
does that mean
know.
We can only enter that figure on the last day of the month?
I'm sorry?
Or can we go in on the first or second and put that in?
You can go in on the first or second. It just automatically creates the survey on the last day of the month.
Okay, great.
Okay. I'll have to go back and look. I've been going in every 3 or 4 days and updating our surveys. I haven't seen that yet, so I'll have to look for it.
It just means you can't go any sooner than the last day of the month to put in the deliveries for the month, which
sure.
is obviously a pretty obvious safety thing to do.
Okay.
This is Huntersville Medical Center. We have a couple of questions. Can you guys speak to the gestational hypertension patients and the chronic hypertension patients that have blood pressures in the mild range and the delivery recommendations for those folks? I know they're not necessarily included in the data collection because there isn't a piece for just the chronic hypertensive patients, but we're finding this, and I'm not really sure how to go about dealing with the situation.
Sure. I can address that. If you look at the PCNIC webpage, I put my whole presentation on there, which goes through all of the ACOG recommendations with reference to when to deliver. It's also in, there's a typed up set of guidelines that's about 4 or 5 pages that goes through chronic hypertension, gestational hypertension, preeclampsia. But just to summarize it, if they have gestational hypertension, then delivery is recommended not before 37 weeks. So that means 37 and 0 anytime after that. If they have a diagnosis of gestational hypertension, they can be delivered. If they have chronic hypertension, but it's not superimposed preeclampsia, and they don't have IUGR or anything else going on, just chronic hypertension by itself, the recommendation is 38 weeks and 0 days.
Okay, great. And is there any place to capture on this audit tool the population that are just strictly chronic hypertensives, or we're just excluding them completely?
My understanding is we're excluding chronic hypertension. Even though it says on one of the things, hypertensive diseases of pregnancy, it does
mm-hmm.
not include chronic hypertension. We're just looking at gestational hypertension, preeclampsia, and superimposed preeclampsia. Is that correct, Tammy, Arthur?
Yeah, that is correct.
Okay.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. And then just one last question. Are we capturing the patients that get transferred for a higher level of care that are antepartum, and how are we following up with those patients?
I think we're only capturing them at the time of delivery.
Yeah, we decided to capture just at the time of delivery for a lot of reasons. Not that it's not an important issue before delivery, but we're going to capture those people when they eventually deliver somewhere. I think it's just easier because there is that transfer of care. You know, we have the beauty of this initiative is that we have hospitals of varying levels of care. So we didn't want to have the risk of double counting people. So delivery is a single event. So it's easy to track and follow. So
it's kind of
okay,
being captured
great.
When you
so
put
much.
In their admission date and their discharge date. So obviously if they've been in the hospital
right.
for 3 or 4 weeks, the implication is they were in the hospital because of preeclampsia.
Right. Right. Potentially. They could have had diabetes or something else, unfortunately, but we're going to assume that. Any other questions for Stuart or any questions about data collection or just any general questions? I think this kind of dialogue is really what I think helps people, you know, do all that good work they're doing at their institutions and, you know, trying to find these, you know, these nuances of, you know, how do I classify someone? Like I told you guys a couple weeks ago, at the last webinar, we had someone who got delivered for, you know, what my MFM called atypical health, and I agree she should have been delivered at 36 weeks. She was sick. But she didn't really fit a nice category, probably because she also had breast cancer and some other comorbidities. I mean, there are going to be people that are just unclassifiable, and that's fine. That's going to happen sometimes. Just do the best you can and use the really nice outline that Stuart gave us to kind of help guide us in trying to make sure we're teaching providers how to classify properly, but also as we're data collecting, we're doing the same thing. So any other questions for Stuart or Tammy or me or anybody in the group or comments?
It's Susie at Presbyterian. I just have a clarifier. So on the data collection, it says date admitted. So going back to what Huntersville was just mentioning, if a patient got admitted to Huntersville, transported to us then for delivery, we're going by the initial admit date. Would that be Huntersville then, not ours, to capture how long they were in before delivery?
I think to me that makes sense. To be honest with you, if you have that information, not everyone has that sort of information handy. You know, I know when we get transfers, I don't always know, especially when they're doing data collection from our charts, how long someone was admitted at the prior institution. But I think if that's the information we can get, I think that's the better descriptor of how long they've been hospitalized. So I think it's hospitalization in general, not necessarily at your institution.
Okay.
This is Ansley at CMC Pineville, and I got a couple of questions, and I think I've got a couple of questions for all of the Carolinas healthcare facilities that are participating, because we got on a conference call to try to streamline how we were collecting data and kind of bounce things off of each other to kind of put together a plan for our system, and we all came up with just, we're having a lot of trouble trying to collect this data. I don't know if it's volume related, but we're having a hard time even figuring out who these patients are. Trying to identify them, you know, as a patient who has been diagnosed with hypertension is very difficult to do in real time. So we've all implored different types of ways for charge nurses to keep, you know, names and medical record numbers written down, to look at triage logs, you know, as patients are admitted. So my first thing is we need some suggestion to help us how to isolate these patients out of the total patient population so we can even audit their charts. And then my second question, you know, once we actually get in an audit, we did do a presentation for our physicians. We reviewed all the ACOG definitions and the changes and how we're going to document preeclampsia. But what I'm finding is when I tried to even go in and put in data on the few charts, and I mean few, 8 charts that I had, if a doctor puts on the chart that the patient has PIH, which I understand, you know, we don't want them to do, but if they do that, and on the actual audit tool, has this patient been diagnosed with, well, I have to put no for all 4 categories because they didn't diagnose them that way. And when you do mark no on all of those, then the second half of the audit tool doesn't open up. So I
right.
can't put in any additional data because the doctor didn't make the correct diagnosis to begin with. So what am I auditing in that number 5? Has this patient been diagnosed with? And then it's got all 4 of the types with the identifiers underneath it. But if the doctors aren't diagnosing correctly, how can I even put data into Delphi?
Right. So my suggestion would be, and what we've been doing, we put in the correct diagnosis. So if someone called a PIH and really have preeclampsia with mild features, it's called preeclampsia with mild features. So it's really what patient the diagnosis have. I can see the wording on Delphi is a little bit awkward. What was their diagnosis? I mean, they were delivered with hypertension. or they had hypertension, I think if you realize it's misclassified, classify it correctly, because our goal is making sure what patients are actually doing, and then locally you're trying to improve that communication between providers and nurses and staff about how you actually talk about them. So it should really be what
right.
they have. And we take a little bit of chart review. I mean, you know, at a place that does 4,000 deliveries and, you know, we're doing about 3,700 deliveries, you know, we have about a 15% rate right now of people that have one of those diagnoses. So that's a fair number of charts. But we actually have nurses kind of going, our select L&D nurses kind of going through it. They know the criteria. And, you know, they've basically been telling me, hey, these docs are really good at diagnosing it. These guys are not. So I'm actually talking to the docs that are not to say, hey, do you realize there is a change? I'm trying to, you know, do focused education. And it's frustrating. How do you find the people with hypertension? You know, and I think it's good that Carolina's, you know, you're probably using the same data systems can help. We do a couple of things. We, you know, we set a very wide net to catch anyone that might have it. So we look at ICD-9 codes at discharge because our coders do, they find diagnoses that didn't know existed on patients. And that might be true in other hospitals. We have one of our chart nurses go through our labor and delivery log. So usually have an indication or some comorbidity section in there. If you have, you know, fetal link or power chart maternity or any other, you know, labor and delivery data system, their diagnosis is in there. You can pull it out of there. So I think the goal is to cast a wide net in whatever resources you have in your institution and then use that to try to find anyone that might have the diagnosis. And you might find some people don't. You may find people you missed, and that's fine. But I think the goal is trying to make sure we capture everybody. And sometimes that means you have a couple of, you know, false positives in your screen and then you kick them out of your data if they really didn't have a hypertension diagnosis. Does that answer your question?
I can tell her. I was going to tell you what we're doing at REC.
Please.
We had 420 deliveries last month, and we looked at every chart. So I just went into every chart. We have nurses that are trying to get on the clinical ladder, so they have to have extra projects. So this is an extra project for them. So we go into each chart and look under the doctor's discharge summary, their H&P, and their progress notes. And if the doctor has not mentioned anything about a problem with blood pressure, then we figure they're not going to be somebody. Now, we have doctors that say elevated blood pressures. So I count that as a patient. And then I go ahead and I categorize them appropriately. But we just kind of tag the ones that have any mention in those three places of having high blood pressures. It doesn't matter how they call it, if they call it CIH, elevated blood pressures, preeclampsia, whatever they say. And we look through all of them and we tag the ones that have blood pressure issues and go back and collect the data on them.
This is Nancy at Avant Health Forsyth Medical Center. What we're doing that has been very successful because like Rex, I mean, we do a lot of births. We do 500 to 550 per month. And we found it very cumbersome to feel we were going to collect data on every patient. So what we did is we have the data collection tool on every chart. So the labor nurse then will dictate whether this patient belongs in the audit and then checks off through the delivery all the appropriate answers and hands that in with, like, the charge sheet. So for patients who don't fall into this initiative, they just recycle that piece of paper. That's been working extremely well for us. We have great compliance with our nurses filling that out. And we have two nurses who, like at Rex just said, use this as their big project for their career ladder, and they're the ones that are putting all the information in Delphi. But that is working really well for us as a large volume facility because going into every record is very cumbersome, and this allows us to do it real time. And then if anything changes through the course of labor, then we incorporate that. Our high-risk maternity care unit has these tools so that if they have a long-term patient who ends up going to C-section, L&D might never see that patient. That way we're incorporating those. And our OR staff are also, if they're scheduled patients coming for sections that L&D doesn't see, then they're also being captured. So we really truly feel we're getting 100% of the patients data collected.
Well, Any other centers have any other ideas that they can, or successes or even failures of things they tried?
I like that idea. This is Ansley again, Carolina's Healthcare System. And we've done it in the past through PCNIC, and we put the PCNIC audit tools on our charts. I think that just right now, part of the reason why we haven't kind of put this burden on the staff to help us with collecting data is we're also doing data on hemorrhage, and we're also doing a PCO2 data, kind of similar to our old PCNIC form for IHI. You know, so it's like we have so many different data tools and so many different things nurses are auditing. And, you know, we were trying to do this without having nurses in real-time audit. But I guess, I mean, I've got to try to find a way that I can get a report out of Cerner or something that will, you know, I can't get coding until about 5 days after the month ends, but I think that might be the route that we'll go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, and I think one of the things that I hear here, and the same thing we're doing at Mission, is, you know, nurses that are looking for clinical ladder projects. I mean, I'm literally looking at my nurse, one of my L&D nurses who's, you know, came up to me and goes, hey, I need a clinical ladder project. I heard you're talking about preeclampsia. I'm in. And she's been amazing because she's motivated. Mm-hmm. She's, you know, understands labor and delivery. She's an L&D nurse. And I think that's leveraging, you know, mutually beneficial outcomes, basically. So I think, you know, looking for those opportunities is really helpful, and it sounds like a lot of people have found those opportunities. You know, just using really smart, dedicated people who have a little bit of, you know, extra motivation, be it for career advancement or just their love of QI, whatever it may be. So, sounds great. You know, I think the other thing down the road, if you're looking at the ways to find people with blood pressure issues, I'm not suggesting doing this yet, but I'm kind of giving you a preview of a couple things I'm hearing down the road. Is one of the, you know, if you can have the ability, if it's a numbers thing, you know, if you can go into your EMR and just pull blood pressures on pregnant women and look for any blood pressure over 140 over 90 as a screening tool, would be kind of interesting because, you know, I'm thinking about this a lot because I'm talking to some people around the country, and one of the metrics we're looking on down the road, I'm not saying it's live yet, is treatment of blood pressure, severe range blood pressure within an hour of the blood pressure being taken. So I think we're going to have to start becoming more involved with that raw data, like, you know, what is that blood pressure measurement? Can we access from the EMR to do quality audits on it? Because that's going to be coming down the line, I think, from some very major governmental organizations that deal with money and reimbursement. So if we start looking at blood pressure measurements in some way out of our systems, it might be something to consider doing that might help us down the road. Just a little tidbit of information for everybody. So any other thoughts, suggestions, successes, failures? Oh, sounds like you guys are just doing amazing things and, you know, working through your issues that come up, and that's just invariably part of taking care of patients, but also doing QI projects. You know, and just keep giving us, you know, if you have questions about anything about diagnosis, data collection, you can email me or Tammy or anybody, and we will definitely want to help you because we're here to support you in doing this. If you have any ideas of topics for the next webinar, let me know. And I want to thank Stuart again for helping, you know, giving that really nice and succinct talk about diagnosis. I think that's a big part of what we're doing. So thank you again, Stuart. Thank you, everybody, for your time and for your commitment. You know, we're here if you need any help. And at the very latest, we'll all be in touch again in April for that webinar.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you.